No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. Maria, how are you?
Michael, it's been a wild ride.
We haven't talked for a while because we
Father's
did
run,
Day. Father's Day, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, while we're on the subject, I want to digress, but if my daughter's out there in Chicago, I still haven't got my Father's Day card.
But she graced you with her presence and that of how many of her friends
eight
the weekend
friends.
Before?
She did. She allowed me to feed her and eight of her friends. So,
and transport and be sightseer, yes, tourist
exactly.
guides. Yeah,
exactly.
Which was, I can't imagine. First of all, I can't imagine eight. So was it nine people total?
No, eight people including her.
Okay. Yeah. Getting eight people's calendars together and clearing them, and then the logistics from Chicago to D.C., and then the weekend, and you and Mrs. Brown, and on and on and on we go. I mean, it was a Herculean thought, let alone execution.
Well, you know, they've got this little travel club, evidently, and they've been going to different places, which I think is really cool. I don't know that we did that much. I did a lot of traveling when I was young, so I think it's pretty cool. But they went to Nashville, I mean, for no reason at all other than they had never been to Nashville. And my brother went to Vanderbilt, so Nashville's a place I've been a lot, and it's really a cool city. I don't know how they picked it, but they went there, and they all went skiing together somewhere in Colorado, and so they picked Washington, D.C., because they had never been, and this some of them had never been, and this is their improv group. She belongs to an improv group, so they all came. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun to have them, and they didn't mind sleeping on air mattresses, and so it all worked out.
And I was at the improv last night in Los Angeles. So,
yeah. Well, it's great to see her perform. It's a lot of fun. When Pat and I go to Chicago, we've been there and we've seen her a few times, and it's really a lot of fun to see her up there, especially for me because my mom was the head of the local community theater in the city in which I grew up. And so I've been going to especially amateur things ever since I was a kid. I've seen lots of Broadway musicals and lots of professional productions here in D.C. Most recently, we saw Hamilton. But I've also seen a lot of amateur stuff in school plays. My mom was, her specialty was children's theater. So seen a lot of children's theater. So it's a lot of fun for me to go to live performances and especially see one of my kids. I'm just sorry that she's not here to see Trisha because she'd just be thrilled about it.
So she comes organically, right, to this, your daughter?
Well,
is genetically predisposed.
You know what? It's one of the great things about being a parent, isn't it? So my mom passed when I was 15 years old a good 25 years before Tricia was born, and nobody ever said anything about the fact that my mother was a tap dancer, my brother was a tap dancer, my sister was a tap dancer. They all tap danced when I was there. But nobody's ever mentioned it, you know. And one day at 7 years old, she just walks up to me and says, "You know what I think would be really cool? If I could take tap dance lessons." I was like, "What?"
Oh, my
goodness. Yeah, I saw. And I was like, and she did. She became the tap captain in her group. And, you know.
Wow. So
really good.
Talk about the power of genetics.
Yeah. And who would have ever thought, you know, and it's not something I ever discussed with, you know, my brother and sister did it because my mom, you know, got them to, a friend of hers was a tap dance teacher. In fact, it was the first woman I ever had a crush on when I was a little boy. Nick the barber. Nick the barber was the local barber. He cut everybody's hair. And his daughter was a tap dance teacher. And so when you sat in Nick's chair, there were like 100 little pictures of his daughter in different tap dance outfits all around his mirror. And she was a really pretty girl. And so, you know, I, at 7 years old, I fell in love with her. All I wanted was take tap dance lessons, but we never got around to it. But anyway, it's amazing how that stuff transfers. And, you know, my son Nicholas studied design at in college, and all of a sudden he starts making furniture. He makes really nice furniture. And my grandfather was a seventh generation cabinet maker. You know, came from a long line. So that thrills me too, you know, to see him doing that. You know, I'm a guy that's
good really, God, in this day and age, making furniture and a young millennial, like what?
Yeah, you know, we're trying to encourage him. I don't know that he sees a future in it, but he just designed several pieces when he was in college that were so nice that they showed them off at the college during graduation. They had a demonstration of different design works, and he, two of his pieces were at the center of the exhibition. So, he does really nice stuff. But I don't know if he sees him, you know, I don't know that he sees himself doing that. I don't know. Nick is looking for his passion right now.
And it's perfectly age appropriate.
Well, geez. His mother has obviously gotten to you, Maria. That's her. Right? Yeah.
I'm in the field of psychology. She's going to be stages in development.
He's going to be 56, and she's going to be saying that it's age appropriate. But anyway, he's a great guy, and he works real hard, and you know, and we just got to motivate him a little bit. But
if somebody is industrious in that way and they are manifesting their passion, how can you fault them for it? Now, genetics, on the other hand, I'm the recipient thereof that, I know you're more private than I'm going to be right here, but I just got diagnosed with cancer on Friday. And my father died of it. My mother had breast cancer. I have a son who's had breast cancer twice. And so then you get that genetics. And it's like, so I got the short stick when it came to like talent and maybe being whatever. And so it's like, dear dad, thank you for passing that along to me. So I've got my surgery scheduled and everything. And it's been just this wild range of emotions because you don't, you know, you always hope it's not going to happen to you. But I know you're really private with some of the maladies that you've had to deal with, which I honestly respect. But I think part of the way I process things is by verbalizing it. And so I got the news on Friday afternoon and I didn't know what to do about my children. Cause I thought, yeah, I could keep this a secret and they don't need to know until after the fact. And, you know, we won't really know until they get in and see what, you know, how big and how much and all that stuff. And then I thought that would be disingenuous to not, because if something bad would happen, shouldn't they have? So I just sent them a text and I said, I'd like to speak with you and not through technology. And I know it's the weekend. So whenever you get around to it, just, you know, give me a shout and I'm happy to have the conversation and all four of them called me. And, you know, I just got to share what I had to share. And so I'm seeing all of them after a program we're getting together tonight. And it's just this journey we call life.
Well, you know, first of all, let me say how absolutely sorry I am that you have to go through this. Also, let me add to that, it's my personal opinion from knowing you for a few years that you're an amazing human being. And if anybody can, you know, get through this, it's you. I mean, you've not only, you know, done so much with your life and keep on doing, keep on going to school, keep on learning, keep on being involved. You know, what you've done for the show, Maria, you know, you've made it professional. We've gone from the lady who wanted to tell us that, you know, infidelity was caused by chocolate to having some of the top politicians in America, you know, like Ralph Nader and Michael Steele on our show. So God bless you for that. You're an amazing person. I hope you understand whatever I can do to help.
I
will certainly
Thank
help.
You.
Is
Thank
it?
You.
Can I ask you? Is it breast cancer?
No, it's on my nose, so it's on my face.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, and I hope you take some solace in this. My brother, as you might know, was an Air Force pilot.
No, I didn't know that. I know that he served in our forces, but I did not know that he was a pilot.
Oh, yeah, of an F-111.
Oh, my gosh.
And he actually was a co-pilot and navigator for most of his career. But then he became a teacher, and he ended up retiring as president of college.
Yes.
But he had skin cancer on his nose. And they decided, you know, that this was not particularly uncommon, given that they flew at such high altitudes. And, you know, they didn't, I guess when he did it, they didn't have the same kind of protective gear that they have today.
That makes sense, because up with that altitude and you're getting the sun without filters, basically.
Well, and that happened to him. I think he was probably diagnosed 25 or 30 years ago.
Oh.
They removed a small, just the piece of the problematic area, and he's never had another problem since. So let's hope that ends up being the same thing with you.
Well, and I actually just attended a brunch this morning. My next door neighbor, they called it a celebration of life. He had stage 3 esophageal cancer surgery 10 years ago today, and he's still around. So I do know that it's not the death sentence that it once was. It's just the unknown, going from the biopsy and waiting the week for the lab results and then now waiting for the surgery that is tenuous. But I'm trying to do is default to gratitude and, you know, live in every moment and keep moving on. The problem I'm having at the moment is it's tough to concentrate for me. So I called the chair of my department yesterday. And I said, you know, I don't want to take an incomplete because I'm just finishing my last statistics class before I get into the meat and potatoes with the dissertation. And she said, look, here's what we can do. Here's what we can do. Here's what we can do. You've got some options here. And I was like, okay, cool. Great. So, because I do not want this to derail my, and then here's the irony, Michael. And I hope does this sound too macabre for us? But I received a scholarship in January of this year from my university, and it was named after a man who got his PhD, and then 3 days later, he died from cancer in his mid-50s. And I said that to her, too. I said, look, his name is not lost on me either. And she was like, okay, let's not go there. And I was like, all right. you know, I don't want to be sticking my head in the sand either.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, one thing you're talking about, things that have been inherited. One thing that I inherited from my mother is I'm incredibly superstitious. My mother believed in every superstition.
Did she?
Oh, my God.
Now, I could see your grandmother doing that, but not your mom.
On New Year's Eve, we used to sweep out the old year, bring in the new. We used to eat gefilte fish. For good luck, I remember saying to my mother when I got older, "We're not even Jewish. Why do we do this?" You know, and we'd eat black beans or something about black eyed peas, and you know, and all these things. So I'm incredibly superstitious. I never ever walk out of my house in the morning without reading my horoscope. And I would say that, given my superstitious nature, that what you just said is a good sign, that he passed it on. They passed on his legacy to somebody that's actually going to make it and make good use of the money. So,
well, between your sister having breast cancer and your brother, that's interesting, talking about genetics.
Yeah, and my mom too. My mom and my sister both had breast cancer, and I can tell you
that I don't know that you ever shared that about your mom.
Yeah, that the both of them, and you know, they've just come so far. When I first started working with Race for the Cure, right after my sister died, I went to a thing called Race for the Cure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nationwide, people probably know it's for breast cancer research for the Komen Foundation.
Correct.
It was actually started by a very nice Republican woman who I met through the...
Her sister.
Yeah, her sister. Well, the woman that... She ended up working for... Maybe... I can't remember who...
Well, Susan G. Komen, it's named after...
But she's
the one that died of breast cancer, right, and it's her sister that created the foundation.
And the sister was appointed, I want to say, by Trump to a government position, or maybe it was Obama, I can't remember. But I met her, and just the loveliest person, and just amazing how much money she's raised for breast cancer research.
It is. I've actually interviewed her a couple of times.
Yeah, it shows you how
really
much
inspirational
one person can do.
Right.
They put their mind to it. And I can tell you, at that first race, survivors wear pink T-shirts. Mm-hmm. And at that first race I went to, there were probably 30 survivors. And now when I go to the race, there's a sea of pink shirts. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of pink shirts. So they've come a long, long way.
My first one that I did, I had a radio program in Sacramento, and that's when I had the, I think her name is Nancy, the sister of Susan mm-hmm. G. Komen. And so we got our listeners to walk, and my husband then and my four children and I were walking. And in front of us was three men, and the older man said, "My daughter died of breast cancer." The younger man said, "My wife died of breast cancer." And then the young boy said, "My mom died of breast cancer." And it was about the same woman that they were walking in the honor of. And when I saw that, I burst into tears. I was like, "Oh my God." And here they are being activists for the cause to help make it not happen for others.
Well, and certainly that was my attitude too, and my sister would have wanted me to do that. I can tell you by the kind of person she was. But one of the reasons that I don't talk about this very much, Maria, although I'm going to share something that just blew me away, an experience that I had when I first was elected. But one of the reasons I don't talk about it with women, especially women that have breast cancer, is because it was such a bad outcome for my mom and my sister. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and so I don't want to depress people, because there's so many positive things that happened, mm-hmm. Has happened since then. I'm, you know, we're talking about 30, my sister's been gone for 30 years. So, you know, so many advances have been made, and that's one of the reasons I don't talk about it. But I've got to tell you that one day I'm elected, I've been elected a couple of years, and a local hospital invites me to come speak for the Komen Foundation. Mm. So I agree to go, and I end up at this forum, and I'm there with the head of the health committee in the District of Columbia, on the council, and three doctors. So the first guy, the head of the Health Committee talks about funding. The next three people talk about patient navigation, which is the idea that, you know, you have an individual that navigates you through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And I suggest this to anybody that goes into any kind of serious treatment. It's an important thing to have. And then they come to me. And the whole time this is going on, I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to sound like an idiot.
Why do you think that?
Because they're all talking in very scientific terms, and all I've got is this anecdotal story about my mother and my sister.
Visceral story?
I'm just thinking this is my tale. So they come to me at the end, and I just want to get through this without being humiliated. So I put my head down, and I don't like to read speeches, but I had a speech prepared and I read it. You know, it was 5 minutes from start to finish. And I looked up and there was a crowd of maybe 50 people and 20 of them were crying.
Yeah.
And then the head of the hospital who was running everything stepped up to the microphone and said, I'm sorry, but I can't go on anymore. I just lost my aunt to breast cancer. And he left the room. He wouldn't talk. And I came home to my wife and I said, it was such a cathartic experience. I had no idea that people would react that way to this little story of my own personal tragedy. But I think they did because so many people can relate to it, like the doctor who had an aunt. You know, they all, it's, and I found this out in years afterwards talking about it. It really has touched so many people's lives, you know, so many people have come in contact.
Well, and that's why I wanted to say that you made it real instead of it being scientific or medical or sanitized or whatever. You made it personal and it was.
Well, and you know what? This is something that we need to do more of in the world. In a minute, I want to get on to talking about what's going to happen at the end of this week. But
yes,
we need to do more of this in politics. We need to, I want to talk about the presidential debates. But you know, we had Marianne Williamson on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'm proud to say we're the first people to have her on, but she talks much about this, about bringing the personal back into politics and reassessing who we are. And I think that's so important to get beyond statistics. And it may be something that Democrats have forgotten how to do. I don't know. I lament that because it's so important for people, especially.
Well, because, you know, that's the one thing that we share is the human condition. And I think we forget that or lose sight of that because we either see superstars or we see people who are bigger than us or better than us or more powerful than us or more wealthy than us or, you know, whatever our standards for comparison are. And yet the truth is, as they say, at the end of the day, everyone puts on their pants one leg at a time. It's, you know, we all have this commonality in the fact that we're human beings. And that to me, like you and me, Michael, that even though we have different letters after our name in terms of our political persuasion, we agree, I think it's almost getting to 90% about, I mean, I talk about D.C., statehood for D.C. all the time, and most people are absolutely, first of all, they're incredulous, second of all, they had no idea, and third of all, they can't believe it. And I'm like, and then people say to me, well, isn't that a Democrat, you know, whatever, and I was like, no, it's about fairness and egalitarianism and equality. Politics comes way last in the my consideration of the situation. And speaking of that, did you not have your hearings?
No, we haven't had them yet. But
aren't they coming up?
Yeah, they are coming up.
Is it next week?
No.
I thought it was this month.
July 24th.
Oh, July 24th. Pardon me.
Yeah. Okay. So first, let me say, you know, besides the fact that coincidentally, we just both happen to be exceptional human beings. but beyond that,
with our foibles and our flaws.
I think that when we all sat down, if we all sat down and could talk to each other, we'd find this commonality. You know, and that's actually what I look for when I look for, and it may be because I'm a politician, you know, being a politician, you're always attempting to get people to like you. So I relate to people. My assistant Karen gives me a hard time about this all the time because I don't care what you say. I find some way to relate to you. You know, if you say to me, "Oh, I'm from Ohio," like, "Oh, my brother's from lives in Ohio," or if you say, "I play the saxophone," I say, "Oh, I used to play the saxophone in junior high," you know, for a whole 2 months where I didn't learn to play. But I'm always looking for that, and I think that I find that with almost everybody. Let me tell you what happened to me last week, which was really funny. I get a phone call at home. I don't think I told this story on the air before, but I get a phone call and this guy says, "Is this Senator Brown?" Mm-hmm. And I go, "Yes." And he goes, "Well, I want to know why we elect you and then we send you to Washington and all you do is screw up and you end up being a member of the swamp and blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah." And he goes on for about 5 minutes. And I start to talk to him. He's a Republican from Indiana. He blah, blah, blah. But anyway, come to find out, he thinks I'm Senator Braun from Indiana. Yeah. It's almost like a Roseanne, Indiana, yeah. You know. Okay. And I say, "No, I'm Senator Brown." And he says, "Where the hell are you from?" And I say, "I'm from Washington, D.C. And we're talking at the end. He says, "Well, it's been great talking to you." Aww. You know, this is a guy that started out attacking me. He said, "It's been great talking to you." And I gave him the phone number to the Capitol. I said, "Ask for Senator Braun, but spell it for them. Mm-hmm. And they will put you into the right office." And you know, he said, "I'm 84 years old. And I go out and I vote all the time." And I go, "Great. You know, that's wonderful." So, you know, even with people that you think you might have you know, disagreements with, mm-hmm. there's so much commonality. And that's what I think when I get into a battle with Republicans, I think of all the Republicans that I know and that I like, many of whom I love, actually members of my family and other people. And I say, you know, this is, you know, the other party isn't bad. They're just different. You know, we have different opinions, and that's right. what the First Amendment's all about, our ability to express those opinions to one another. Right. And we're losing that, and I hate it. The more I see it, the more I hate it. I don't know. We still have not gotten to the bottom of this, but somebody ran over 10 Marines over the weekend. I don't know if you've heard about this, but somebody in a truck, a pickup truck pulling a trailer, hit
ten
Marines on motorcycles.
Yes, I did.
Killed seven of them.
I didn't realize it was deliberate. I thought it was an
accident.
They
don't know if it's deliberate. Okay. Let's hope it wasn't deliberate. Let's hope it's just a terrible.
Yeah, but I was thinking, how do you have that much carnage with a single incident?
Yeah, it's really kind of hard to believe, except he was pulling a trailer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you've ridden a motorcycle for many, many miles.
Decades, yeah.
And you know, yeah, if you're in close formation,
right,
a truck with a trailer on it might just be long enough to hit 10 motorcycles. I mean, it would be hard to believe it. Hey, we've got a caller online too. Let's
Bonnie.
Bonnie, let's see what she has to say. Bonnie, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Maria, I just wanted to let you know that I am so sorry to hear about the skin cancer, but I've got kind of really good news. My mom was a medical professional in RN for many years, and she got skin cancer when she was 50 years old, and she is now 91.
Oh!
And in perfect health.
So you think she's recovered from that after 40?
Well, I think she might have recovered this gig.
I'll take 41 more years. You betcha.
But you know what? 41 years from now, Maria Sanchez will be working on her 6th PhD. I guarantee you. She'll be working on a degree that makes her doctor of everything.
Eradicated female genital mutilation. That's my goal.
Okay. All right.
Bonnie.
Anyway, that's really all I had to say. I just wanted to give you that good news.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thank you for that,
calling.
Bonnie. Yeah.
Okay.
That's so sweet of you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, because that's why I went to the United Nations, Michael, is that there was a conference about global health. And there were 5 presenters, and one of them was the ambassador from Sierra Leone, which is a country in Africa. And UNICEF records, so female genital mutilation is something that's done in about 30 countries in the world, and 200 million women are alive today who have been cut, and they cut them from 1 week old to up to 15 years of age.
I don't get it. Is it a religious thing?
There are some countries and imams that would suggest that it's such, but it is not in the Quran. It is not in the Bible. It goes back 6,000 years. It's about controlling women and their sexuality at the end of the day. And so they think by excising the genitalia, it will keep them chaste, thus making them more desirable for marriage, thus making the dowry bigger. There's all kinds of reasons that it's complicated.
So does genital mutilation keep them from procreating? No.
It makes it very, very, very difficult. There's 4 different types of cutting, and the type of cutting that's done the most is all of the females' genitals are cut, and then they are sewed up. So that there's a tiny little opening for them to urinate and to menstruate from, thus making physical intercourse very difficult, which is part of the reason, so that they don't. And then when they do get married, then they're often married off early, like at 15. It also causes carnage and damage. So there are procedures to undo the cutting. And I mean, I'm learning more and more and more, and it's just more and more terrible. But Sierra Leone, so Somalia has a 98% cut rate. Egypt has like a 92% cut rate. Sierra Leone has a 90% cut rate. So I went to the ambassador after the conference and I said, let's talk about female genital mutilation. And she like recoiled from me. Like, why? What do you want to know? And I said, well, according to UNICEF, you have a 90% compliance rate. And some manhandler came up and he said, what do you want to know? And I said, so it's called FGM for short, female genital mutilation. I said, so I just was curious about your high compliance rate. Oh, no. Nope, we've made it illegal. No one can get cut unless they're 18 years of age. And at that point, they're an adult and it's their decision. And I was like, oh, interesting. And the truth is that they have a 90% compliance rate. So I'm working globally, and by attending that conference in the United Nations, I've now made contact with international activists who are actually the women from their culture who speak their language, who have been cut, who have decided that they want to eradicate it. So my goal is to psychologically give them tools with media assets that they then can get their boots on the ground and go ahead and keep this momentum going. And that's why I went to the United Nations.
Wow.
So it delivered more than I could have ever hoped for, because I've even, like yesterday, I was given the name of a journalist from The Guardian, which is the major newspaper in the United Kingdom. And this is one of her things. And she said to me, I'm going to put you in touch with the activist that actually had it declared illegal in 2016 in the Gambia, which is another country that cuts in Africa. And so all of a sudden now I'm getting into the inbox of these women who have been doing it. And again, it's their culture, it's their people, it's their language, it's their tradition. And if they can make a difference, then I just want to be the person that provides them with whatever collateral materials they need. Because UNICEF, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations have all declared it an international health emergency, but nobody's doing anything about it. Because everybody's afraid that we're stepping on toes, we're being politically incorrect, or as I've been told, you're a white Western woman trying to invade another culture. How dare you? Who are you?
Well, you know what? But that has, how many times has that been successful? That's been successful many times. A lot of times it takes somebody from another culture, right, to bring some sensibility to things like this. I don't care what you're talking about.
Well, we gave black men the right to vote, and then we gave women the right to vote. And, I mean, we've done things in our own culture that we had culturally had traditions that we didn't do. So cultural traditions and change is possible. We look at, we've eradicated nearly polio and malaria. And I mean, there's lots of examples of it. But when I went to the conference at the University of Leeds, which was the end of April, that was a 2-day conference about keeping the EU intact. So it was all about genital cutting and how not to and what to do. 85% of it was devoted to male circumcision. But this woman from Somalia spoke, which has a 98% compliance rate. She was 7 when she got cut, so she unfortunately remembers everything. And then she came to the UK as a refugee, and she got herself undone surgically, and she got married, and she has 7 children. She doesn't cut. And she said, I don't care if you're black or white or blue. Do what you can to get this stopped, because this, at the end of the day, is child abuse.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you a personal story, and that is that we had a young woman that worked in our office, and I was just amazed at her story. And her story is she came from Saudi Arabia. She had bad burns on her that she got from some childhood accident. She went to a hospital in Philadelphia where they did a series of skin grafts to her. She was evidently from a pretty well-off family. And she walked out of the hospital at 16 and never went home. She didn't go home. She didn't go back to her parents. She stayed in the United States. And back when the Saudis were trying to, she went to college here. She found a college in Tennessee where you could go and work. It was works. The whole college was work study, so you didn't have to pay tuition. So she went there. She got a bachelor's degree. She ends up coming to Washington. She runs into some Saudi who says, if you're a woman and you can prove to us that you're a Saudi national, we'll pay for you to go to graduate school for free, because we're trying to, you know, this is a PR thing to show how much we like women. So she did it. She got a doctorate degree. And the day she became a United States citizen, I said to her, you know, how proud we were of her. She worked in our office, that she was going to become a citizen. But I said to her, how brave you were.
Yes.
To walk out of that hospital as a 16-year-old, 15, 16-year-old, and not go back to your family. And she said, why would I go back there? They hate women. They hate women. They beat you for kissing your boyfriend. Why would I want to be in a place that hates women? Wow. And I just was stunned by that. Stunned that she said that. But you know, how do we get women haters? We're all raised by them. We all have sisters. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, this is an argument I have with my wife sometimes when she tells me I'm a misogynist. I say to her, you know what? I was raised by women.
Yes.
I didn't have a male teacher until I was in high school. My father wasn't part of my life, really. I was raised by 3 women. You know, we all suffer from, you know, women suffer from it too. But I don't know how that happens. You know, if there's a better of our species, it certainly is female as far as I'm
concerned. So I consider you a feminist, Michael.
I know. My wife calls me one of the great theoretical feminists. In theory, I'm a great feminist. I just don't believe in that for my wife or my daughter. You know?
But, well, it's
theoretical,
when,
yes.
So one of two of the women, one in Kenya and one in the Gambia, who have made a difference, they've been recognized by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world in separate years, in 2017 and 2018. And both of them are cut. And it was they went to their fathers and they asked them to change it. A lot of it is also, it's a polygamous society, so there's lots of wives and lots of daughters. And this one woman went back and back and back and even talked to the imam of their community, who he pulled in the Quran, and she was like, no, it's not in the Quran. And he says, and we really respect your father. And she said, and so do I, but we've got to stop the cutting. So his fourth wife had, I don't know what daughter it was of his, and she talked to the mother, who's, they call them sister wives. So anyway, she said, are you going to cut? And she said, yes, of course. And so then she went to her father and she said, please, blah, blah, blah. The long story short is that it's the first girl in their family that's not going to be cut, according.
Well, let me ask you, this is a society that doesn't believe in sex, but they're polygamous?
Yes.
Boy, yeah. It never ceases to amaze me the things we can justify to ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, right?
You know,
I don't want you to have sex, but I want to have sex with my four wives.
Yeah. I was in Senegal in 2008 digging a well for the women in a village to give them water 12 months a year instead of just monsoon dependent. And they were freely speaking about their polygamy and their four wives and the sister wives. And I was interviewing all of them for journalistic reasons. And one of our interpreters was the 19th child of her father. And it was his fourth wife that was her mother, and on and on and on. But not once did they mention cutting. And subsequently, I've come to understand that Senegal is a huge cutting country. So it was interesting to me now, in retrospect, as I'm doing my research, they would talk about the four wives, because they limit it to four, but they never spoke about the cutting.
Well, first of all, let me just say, on the issue of polygamy, I've never really understood why you'd want four women yelling at you for not lifting up the toilet seat. But you know, I really don't get that. But that's amazing. Well, look, we got to move on a little bit.
Okay, yes, please.
Because first of all, the show, you know, one of the primary objectives of the show is to talk about statehood. This has been a big week for statehood.
Okay.
Big, amazing couple of weeks since last we talked. First, as you mentioned, there is going to be a hearing on July 24th, which we assume will lead to a floor vote in the House on the bill that we have now to make the district a state. And in the last, since last we talked, we have many new co-signers.
Oh, my gosh.
Eight new co-signers. Mike Sherrill. So let's shout out to him. Mike Sherrill, New Jersey's 5th. Lucy McBath, Georgia's 6th district. Denny Heck, Washington State 10th district. Vincent Gonzalez, Texas 15th. Amy Barra, California 7th district. Raul Ruiz, California 36th. And Henry Kuehler, Texas 28th district. Thank you, representatives, for all signing on. California now has 42 co-signers. The next closest is New York with 19.
Oh my gosh, more than double.
And on the Senate side, Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire signed on to the bill. And now we have both senators, Senator Hassan and Senator Shaheen from New Hampshire. We have 213 co-sponsors in the House. The bill can pass with 218 votes. So we're really close to even having enough co-sponsors that we can pass the bill, and we have 33 in the Senate. We are concentrating on the Senate.
Yeah.
We're arranging meetings. I have my first meeting with the United States, another United States senator tomorrow. So hopefully next week, maybe we'll have another Senate co-signer. We're very excited about that.
So, Michael, walk us through what's going to happen. So what's the best case scenario with the hearings next month?
Right now, the best case scenario is we have a hearing. There's a floor vote. The vote passes the House of Representatives, gets sent on to the Senate on the Senate bill. I don't know that we can get a hearing in the Senate, but it's not likely that it will pass in the Senate. For us, we would like to get some more Senate co-sponsors because this is never going to go away. We're not going anywhere. And in the next Congress, if you get 218 co-sponsors in this Congress, in the next Congress, you'll get most of them again. And that's the idea, is that sooner or later, this has become a partisan issue. As you know, we have 251 co-sponsors now, and each one of them is a Democrat. So the hope
is... So not a single Republican?
No, but we're working on one. We got one in the hopper, and maybe I'll announce that next week. We'd love to get one. We think all we have to do is get one Republican, and then things will change on the Republican side of things. But if we don't, and it remains a partisan issue, both houses of Congress have been Republican in the past, and both houses of Congress have been Democrat in the past, and sooner or later, both houses will be Democrat again. And if we keep on building co-sponsors, we'll pass it through both houses. And then it just needs to be signed by the president, and then it would happen. So that's the hope. The hope is that we keep on pushing, get more co-sponsors, and when the stars align, we'll be ready to make it happen. Speaking of which, Democrats, I think it would be easier to list the Democrats who are not running for president than to list the ones that are, but they're all lining up this Wednesday and Thursday for the first presidential debate. There's going to be 20 people and 2 hours, okay?
How are they going to do that in two hours?
Well, 2 hours each. So you have 10 people in 2 hours. So that's...
10 people per hour.
No, 10 people together because it's on two nights. Okay? So let's say you give each one of them a 3-minute opening statement. All things being equal, that only leaves 9 minutes to talk to each one of them. Including answers, questions, commercials, whatever there may be. There may not be any commercials, I don't know. But doesn't seem like a lot of time. Anyway, the moderators, I'd like your opinion on this. I think the moderators are very, very interesting. You have Chuck Todd. He seems kind of like a natural because he's a political reporter. But you also have Savannah Guthrie, who's the morning talk show, right? She's the Today Show. Lester Holt, who's more of an investigative reporter. Rachel Maddow.
Rachel News.
Yeah, Rachel Maddow, who we all know.
Is very biased.
And a little excitable at times.
Yes.
So it's interesting. I think just the pick interviews is very interesting. Strange kind of mix. But I'd like to say a few words about one that was on our show. Now, you may not know this, Maria, but we've invited most of these candidates to be on our show.
Okay.
We haven't heard from, we may have been turned down by one or two of them, but most of them haven't even responded. Marianne Williamson, however, came on the show and she spoke and,
eloquently.
And, this woman has an important message. Now, I don't think she's, I'm a realist. I don't think she has the money and the backing to go all the way. But,
or the name recognition, which is surprising to me.
But let's look what she's done. there were two ways that you could qualify for this. Many of the people, some of them who've even made it on the debate, have only qualified in one way, but Marianne qualified both ways. She got 65,000 individual contributions. In fact, she got more than that, but she got a minimum. That was the criteria, 65,000. She went over that. And in addition, she registered 1% in more than three nationwide polls. So she made it. And she's on the stage with the big people on the second night. She's not on Wednesday, she's on Thursday. But the other people that night are Biden, Sanders, Kamala Harris, Buttigieg, and Gillibrand.
Whoa.
So
what, did they just randomly pull names?
They randomly pulled them. And so Biden, Sanders, Harris, and Buttigieg are all top contenders.
Yeah.
The only top contender that's
on
not
Wednesday is Elizabeth Warren.
It's Elizabeth Warren, right. I guess it depends on what poll you read, but yeah, of the top group, she's the only one that's not on Thursday night. So it'll be interesting. I encourage everybody to watch, and I hope that, I just hope as a Democrat that these people start talking about the issues that are important to America. Because, look, if you go out there and say, all we want to do is get rid of Donald Trump, I don't think that'll be enough for the American people.
I agree.
I think the American people want to know what you're going to do for them.
Right.
I think there are plenty of things that Democrats can do for them, and I think they need to talk and speak to those issues. It's like we said before, if you can't sit down and talk to people about what's really important to them and you can't connect on those really important issues, then you're never going to get anywhere, you know?
Well, it's like our earlier conversations after the election, that it can't just be about resist. It has to be about substance.
It can't.
What is it that you want to do, not what is it that you don't want to do?
Yeah, it is. So important to make that connection and tell people that, you know, it's one thing to tell people you care about them, but you've got to show them that you care about them. You've got to show that they're something that they can resonate with.
Yeah. And Ralph Nader, when he was our guest, he had a 3-point plan that was really logical. The first being that maybe Trump is going to implode on his own, shoot himself in the foot for once and for all. But I thought he had a real cogent, proactive way of approaching this. And I think there's so many in the field this time because there were so many in the Republican field last time that kind of opened the floodgates. Because weren't there 18, I believe, Republicans
I can't remember how many there were at first, but there were certainly a lot of them.
Yeah, and so that's why I guess it's now, quote, the norm instead of the exception. But are the moderators the same both nights?
I believe they are, yes.
Okay, so that at least we have some consistency there then. I'm happy to hear that. And wow, what a cluster, huh?
Yeah, what a cluster. And, we have to focus on America. When we go out and we protest, we have lots of thousands of people walking down the street, and we're chanting, this is what democracy looks like. Well, the Democrats have to realize that Donald Trump, this is what democracy looks like. He was elected by the American people.
Right.
You need to speak to the American people.
Correct.
Because it's not, him and whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be are not going to go into a ring and punch it out with each other. They're right. going to appeal to the American people, and it's the American people that are going to decide, and that's what you need to do. It's not just about getting your people out to the polls. It's about making America think again and making America care again and making them believe that you're the people that they can make that happen.
Well, in my humble estimation, at the end of the day, every election should be about giving people, the majority of the people, what it is that they want, not the minority of people who care to show up to vote.
That's right. And you know what? That's why we're always so, you know, interested in getting more voter turnout, so that the people that show up to vote are the people that, you know, that are represented. Here in the District of Columbia, our business is politics, and less than 50% of the people show up to vote in non-presidential years. And in presidential years, it's just over 50%. It's just unbelievable to me. But on that note, Maria, we have to go. And we're going to leave you with the song tonight from the late, great Sam Cooke. Hopefully Washington, D.C. will be a state soon. And God bless you, Maria Sanchez. And please know that we're all praying for you.
Thank you, Michael.
Because you're an incredible person.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate that. And we thank your listeners for making us a part of your lives.
And we'll be back next week.
Yes, we will.
All right.
Give the people their right to vote.